Tov, Chodesh Tov, and Chanukah Smecha. A few years ago, when I first got married, about 10 years ago, we lived in Israel for the year. And on Chanukah, Shabbat Chanukah, we decided to go to Eilat. And we stayed at a new hotel, Herod's Palace. It was very nice. It was because it was new and things were going and things weren't set up quite properly, we got a good discount. So we're sitting there Friday night waiting for Shabbat dinner to start, and we're sitting in the lobby, and then somebody comes up and announces in honor of Chanukah and the new hotel, we're going to have a fashion show, right? And then they proceed to have a whole big fashion show, right? That's how they celebrate Chanukah. So I want to bring this as an example of what the Hellenism is not supposed to be, right? People who have got a little confused about what Chanukah is really all about and celebrating it in a bit of the wrong way. Another example, another model, who's seen the Maccabees video on YouTube?
What are the Maccabees?
Okay, right, so this is an amazing example. Only 2.5 million people saw it, so I figured some of you must have seen it.
I've heard of them, okay, because all these people on Facebook keep putting, I never get around to clicking them.
Okay, after the shiur tonight, go home and check it out. I don't know who, I mean, 2.5, there's not even that many Jews, right, so I don't know who's watching this. But this here, they're taking a pop song that's all about clubbing, right, and represents really the lowest of American values, materialism, promiscuity, just the basis things. And it takes the song, and Hanukkahizes it, right? And now it's making a great Kiddush Hashem, bringing great pride to YU, and everybody, because of through the popularity of the song, using Hellenism for the advancement of Judaism, right? Mm-hmm. So here's an example of good Hellenism. So this is what I want to talk about these two models. We saw a few examples last week, how they, the Hashmonim take this pagan holiday of the winter solstice, right, and they give it now religious meaning, or they take the example of the Greeks used to force them to walk around on Antiochus' birthday, which was every month, with ivy bands on their heads, right, in honor of Dionysus. And then when they regained the Beit HaMikdash, they again took ivy wands, but this time in honor of Sukkot, right? So these are good examples of the way that they take things from the outside, from Hellenism, and kiddushify them and bring them in. Okay. So we ended off last time around the time of Yehuda Maccabi, and so what I want to do tonight is to go further and see what happens to the rest of the Hashmonaim, and see how they deal with Hellenism themselves, and then also see how the Hashmonaim were remembered by Chazal, by the Rishonim, and in modern times, and also how Chazal dealt with Hellenism. What kind of balance did they make in this equation? Right, all these things that are brought up during this period, we want to see how they go forward. Okay, so I'm going to deal with, I want to look through the Hasmonean dynasty and look at some of their political achievements and look at some of their coins. We know, the chief sources we know about them is from the Book of Maccabees, Josephus, and coins that we found. So the coins could be very interesting. Here's a coin of Antiochus. Okay, so now we know what he looks like. But moving on, this is the Hasmonean dynasty. You have Matityahu, might be a little small. Matityahu has 5 sons. They're all involved in battle. Most of them die in battle. The ones in orange are the ones that are leaders of the movement. The other ones are just fighters. So you have Elazar, Averon. He's famous because in one battle there was an elephant and he believed that Antiochus V was on this elephant. And so he heroically ran up and stabbed the elephant from underneath, and the elephant died and crushed him. That's how he died. They lost that battle anyway. But another one is John Gadi, not to be confused with the mafia boss, but God from his blessed like God. He's also seems like he's killed in battle. But the ones that do take over are first Yehuda Maccabi, then Jonathan, and then Shimon. I will talk a little more about these. And then Shimon's sons and grandsons and great-grand sons, and then follow and take over. So let's look at each one. Yehuda Maccabi. We have a sense that when Yehuda Maccabi won, he won everything. But actually, he regained the Beit HaMikdash and purified it. And he had a very small, area of reign. I mean, really just Jerusalem and some outskirts. I mean, he didn't gain a lot of political power, right? He was just able to hold off the Greeks and the Hellenizers. But then after him, Jonathan is able to conquer a little bit more land, and he gets a little bit more power, and he uses that power to declare himself to be the Kohen Gadol. This is very significant, right? Because now we have, we already had Jason and Menelaus, who are Kohen Gadols, and not from the line of Tzadok, but here's Hasmonean, who makes himself, they are Kohanim, but not from the line of Kohanim Gedolim. It's right at this time that we hear of sectarianism in the Second Temple period, right? The Pharisees, Essenes, and Sadducees, right? And so we're not sure how far back they go, but this is the first time Josephus talks about them. And it looks like one of the main gripes that especially the Siddukim have, the Sadducees, is that here's a person that's not from the line of Tzadok. The Sadducees were mostly priests and aristocrats, right? And they believed in Tzadok. And here you have someone not from Tzadok taking over the Kehuna Gedolah. So they were really upset about that. The Essenes, who seem like they're a branch off of the Sadducees, are also upset. They're so upset about it that they decide to leave Jerusalem and go off and live in the Dead Sea. Near the Dead Sea, because you know, they can't even compromise and even live with it. And so they go off, they form the Dead Sea sect, and they say, we're going to stay out here in exile until Mashiach comes, until the end of days, and then we'll be able to regain the Beit HaMikdash and kick out the wicked priest, what they called Jonathan, the Hasmonean, and we'll regain the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so his calling himself high priest was very controversial, to say the least. Pharisees also were against it. Okay, after that we have Simon. One more thing about Jonathan, and the Book of Maccabees records a letter that he writes. He writes a letter to the Spartans, saying that we are brothers. In general, everybody in the Greek world, you're split up into two, right? You're either Greek or barbarian, right? They're called barbarians because they didn't speak Greek, and so whatever they said just sounded like bar. So they're barbarians. Now everybody wanted to be part of the Greeks, and so people from all over would try to find genealogical connections, right? We are your ancient cousins, and they go back in the genealogical books and find that we are really descendants from some Greek a long time ago, and that way they could claim that they were Greeks also. Jonathan does something similar. He sends a letter to the Spartans saying, "We are both children of Abraham, right?" And therefore, we're brothers, what's mine is yours, what's yours is mine, and let's be together. And in fact, you wrote us a letter, it looks like they forged this letter, right? Someone in this court wrote supposedly a letter that the Spartans had written Jonathan, talking about how we're brothers and how we're all connected. But the funny twist here is that they're saying that the Spartans are really part of Abraham, right? So in other words, instead of saying we're Greeks, they're saying the Greeks are, this group is part of us, right? So it's a nice twist on this idea. Okay, so that's just one example of even the first Maccabees taking part in Hellenism. They want to be connected. They want to be part of the Greek people. Okay, Simon, Shimon, is also high priest and ethnarch or governor, and this is very significant. He's granted a tax exemption by Demetrius. Demetrius is the Seleucid king at the time, and he says the Jewish people no longer have to pay tax. Right? The significance of that is they're totally independent. This is the first time since the first Beit HaMikdash, since Jehoiakim, that the Jewish people has their own state and they're totally independent. right? Even before that, the Hashmonim before that, even though they had, they were Kohen Gadol and they were able to govern themselves, they were still under the thumb of the Seleucids. Simon is the first to gain total independence. He takes out the Seleucid garrison from Jerusalem. Unfortunately, he's murdered by his own family, his son-in-law. And so his son takes over, John Hyrcanus. You could see just from this map, right? The green is is what he inherited, and the purple part is the area that he gains in wars. So he's very successful in that. He goes down here to Edom, and he forces them to convert. Probably the only time in Jewish history where we actually forced other people to get circumcision. Accomplished that it was able to increase the borders and increase the population. There was a negative side effect, which is that one of the people that was converted was the grandfather of Herod. And so Herod is going to come back to subjugate the Hasmoneans and kill off the whole family. So I'm not sure if that was the best idea. But anyway, Herod actually is not Jewish at all. His mother was totally not Jewish, and his father was a forced convert. So he's a half-forced convert. Okay, another thing John Hyrcanus does is he destroys the Samaritan temple. Samaritans don't believe that the temple should be in Jerusalem, right? They believe it should be on Har Gerizim, in Shechem. And there was always animosity between Samaritans and the Jews. In fact, when the Jews tried to build the second Beit HaMikdash, back in the time of Zerubbabel, Samaritans came and gave them a hard time and stopped them for many years. And so there was always fighting, and finally John Hyrcanus got the power, and he was able to, he went to Shechem and he destroyed their temple. Okay, the Mara actually has an interesting story about John Hyrcanus. This story is recorded both in the Talmud and by Josephus. Slight differences, but mostly the same. It's always fun to see parallels in the Josephus and in the Mara. So this is the story in the bottom. Now, once happened that King Yanai, Sigmar talks about it as King Yanai, but really Josephus talks about it as John Hyrcanus. He went to Kohelet and he conquered 60 towns. So one of these places, and he conquered a lot of land. And on his return, he rejoiced exceedingly and invited all the sages. He said to them, "Our forefathers ate mallows, type of flour that poor people eat, when they were engaged in the building of the second temple. Let us too eat mallows in memory of them." So mallows were served on golden tables, and they ate. Now there was a man there, frivolous, evil-hearted, and worthless, named Elazar, son of Poira, who said to the king, "O King Yanai, the hearts of the Pharisees are against thee." "So what shall I do?" he said. "Test them with the plate between your eyes." In other words, with the seats, right? Dress up as a Kohen Gadol, and see what their reaction is going to be. See, they're not going to like it. So he tested them, and there was an elder, and his name looks like part of the Pharisees, and his name was Yehuda ben Gedidiah, was present there. He said to King Yanai, "King Yanai, let the royal crown suffice thee, and leave the priestly crown to the seat of Aharon." Because it was rumored that his mother had been taken captive in Modi'in. During the original fight, the generation before, his mother was taken captive, and therefore he's an illegitimate priest, and so therefore he shouldn't be priest. The charge was investigated, but found to be false. And the sages departed in anger. The king was angry at them. So then, Elazar said to King Yanai, "King Yanai, this is the law even for the most humble man, and you, a king and priest, should that be the law for you?" Looks like there's something missing here, but the story in Josephus is that he asked the Pharisees, what should be the punishment for this person who charged you falsely? And they said lashes, but not death. He doesn't deserve death. And so then the troublemaker says, is this the right law? Doesn't he deserve death for blaspheming a king? You see that they let him off lightly with a slap on the wrist, slap on the back, right? And so you see that they really agree with him and they really hate you and they don't recognize your legitimacy. So he said, what should I do? So if you take my advice, trample them down. Well, what happened with Torah? The picture King Alexander, John Hyrcanus as caring about what's going to happen with the Torah. He says, "Behold, it is rolled up and lying in the corner. What wishes to study?" Right? It's all written down. They can go and read it. Let him go and study. They say that the spirit of heresy was instilled in him, for he should have replied, that is, well, for the written Torah, what about the oral Torah? And straight away, because of this, all the sages of Israel were massacred, and the world was desolate until Shimon ben Shatach came and restored the Torah to its pristine glory. Okay, well, this story is significant because it represents a turn, a sharp turn, in the Hasmonean kingdom. Whereas before this, the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, represented faithfulness to to tradition, to Torah, to religion. And here is when John Hyrcanus makes a break, and he kills many sages, and he goes the other way. Okay. So John Hyrcanus is the one that shifts. And that shift continues. Actually, we could see this shift in his coins. John Hyrcanus is the first one to mint coins. And what do you see here? Can you tell what this is? It's a little bit hard to tell. This in the middle is a pomegranate. And on the sides are cornucopia, right? Horns of plenty. Okay, so two of them. So representing, right, economic success and plenty. Now, this is an interesting symbol, right, because where do cornucopia come from? They actually come from Greek mythology. Zeus, says, was brought up by a goat, gave him milk, and one day he was playing with the goat, and he accidentally broke off one of his horns. And so he felt bad, so he blessed the horn and made it magical. Whoever has it can get any wish that he wants. And so that became known as the Horn of Plenty, and that eventually came to symbolize many different gods, Greek gods. Right? So this is really fascinating, right? That this Hasmonean should take this Greek symbol of plenty and put it on his coin as a sign of the success of his empire. Now, that's on one side. On the other side, can you read that? It's in Hebrew, but it's in Paleo-Hebrew. Right? This is Ktab Ivri, which looks like this. Right? You ever see this alphabet? This is the original Hebrew alphabet. This is the alphabet that the Shnei Luchot HaBrit were given on. So here you have, each letter comes from a pictogram. Like Aleph means a ram. This is a ram's head with his two horns. Right? Lamed means whip. Right? Lilmod, to teach, it really comes from to whip. Mem means mayim, so you see it just like a little wave. Ayin is an I. An older version had a dot in the middle. You can see taf means a mark, or X marks a spot, or a cross. Sheen is like shinayim, teeth. Resh is a head. Kof is a monkey, looks like his tail. You have kaf is something like a hand, or a palm, and this is supposed to be a hand. Okay, vav is a hook. Right, so they all mean something else. And so John Hyrcanus and his coins uses Paleo-Hebrew to spell out Yohanatan, HaKohen HaGadol VeChevet HaYehudim. Chevet HaYehudim means the Council of the Jews. So it's pretty, another one minted by Yohanan and the Council of the Jews. Interesting, it doesn't use the word Sanhedrin, which is a Greek word, Sanhedrion, but rather the Hebrew equivalent, Chevet HaYehudim. Okay. So now, why is this Paleo-Hebrew? Already at this time, nobody is using Paleo-Hebrew. Right? From the time of Ezra, everything was switched over into the modern Hebrew script, which is the Aramaic script. So why do you think he's using old Hebrew letters? Any ideas? Yeah. Okay, exactly. He wants to give himself self-legitimacy, connect himself back to the first Beit HaMikdash when they used the old letters, right? So I'm a king like the original kings. I'm going to use the same, right, old script. So what you have is really something amazing. It's literally the two sides of the coin, right? He's thoroughly Jewish and wants to establish his authority based on the Bible and on ancient Israelite traditions, but he's also a Greek and uses a Greek symbol of plenty, right, to symbolize himself. This is a picture of it where it's made out of bronze. That's why it turns that color. We only found coins from the Hasmonaim in small denominations. No silver or gold coins. Which probably means that the economy is still kind of poor and those coins weren't being used very much. Okay, here's another one that actually has a cornucopia also and a helmet, right? Interesting symbol, reflecting their military victories. Contrast this, by the way, with the Bar Kokhba coins. Bar Kokhba is a couple of hundred, 300 years later, when the Jews are trying to get independence from the Romans, and they are successful for a very short time, and they start minting coins right away, and their coins also use Paleo-Hebrew, right? This says, Shimon, right, Bar Kokhba, and it says Lichirut Yerushalayim for the freedom of Yerushalayim, and the pictures that he uses is a lulav and an aron in the Beit HaMikdash, right? See how different the symbols that they choose, right? He wants to bring back, you know, Judaism. Although he's not as successful, right? Here's another coin. This says Shana Bet Lechirut Yerushalayim, second year when they were successful. There is no third and fourth year because it doesn't work. But here you have a lyre and trumpets, right? Very nice. But the Hasmoneans don't choose these symbols. Okay, moving on to John Hyrcanus' son, Yehuda Aristobulus. Notice the change in names. Okay, Matityahu, all his children have good biblical names, Hebrew names. After that, you have Hyrcanus Aristobulus, right? He has two names, right? Yehuda and Aristobulus. So he has, you know, just like we have a Hebrew name and an English name. So already you see some Hellenization there. Aristobulus calls himself the king, the first to do that. He has some family problems, and prince's mother and brothers, kills another brother. He's only around for a short time, but he's able to get the Galilee. He's married to a woman named Salome Alexandra.
Yeah. There's something I don't get. Why does the Greek Empire put up with these expansions?
Put up with these
expansions?
Expansions? Okay, good question. The Hasmoneans are strong. They have a strong military. They were one of the strongest militaries in the area. And they proved their success, so they're able to. You're right, there are always negotiations when they start getting things like Gaza, which was never a part of their inherited land. Then the Seleucids come and say, yeah, you can't have that. If you want that, you have to pay us 1,000 silver coins, right? And they say, well, you know, I'm going to make it 100. You know, there are negotiations, and the Jews do claim, they say, in general, in Greek society, in Greek culture, if you take over land by force, it doesn't mean that it's legitimately yours. It goes back to the people that are there previously. But the Hashmonim say, this is our ancestral land, we were here previously before that. So there is interesting discussion about what's the proper claim for land, and they do have to justify it sometimes. But otherwise, might makes right. Here's a coin that Aristobulus makes. This is an interesting coin because it actually has three sides. But no, I'm just kidding. But again, you have the cornucopia and Yehuda, HaKohen HaGadol B'Chevel HaYehudim. Aristobulus is only around for a year. Not that significant. Much more significant is Alexander Yanai, his brother, another son of John Hyrcanus. He again is also king and high priest. He married Salome Alexandra, his sister-in-law.
Okay, right? How did he?
Is that okay? Well, if they had no children, then it would be boom, it would be a mitzvah, right? But it's more likely that they did have children, and so that means this is incest. I don't think he cared about that too much, though.
How did he die? How did she come to become a widow? Did he die of natural causes?
Yeah, I think he died in battle. Okay. Okay, so first you see his military success. I mean, this is just a huge area. Across the Jordan, down below, Gaza, a huge area of the coast. So this is the biggest that the state of Israel has ever been, right? Since the time of David, and even today we don't have all these parts. Right? So this is really an amazing achievement. So as proud as we might be about those achievements, they came at a very high price. He was a Sadducee, and so when he's Kohen Gadol and he goes up in to do the services, most of the masses of people are Pharisees. And so he always has to negotiate that because you don't want the masses against you. So one time, famous story on Sukkot, he's doing the Avodah and he skips Nisuch HaMayim, the libation of the water, because the Sadducees don't believe in it and the Pharisees do. So he skips it and everybody's there and say, look, he didn't do it right. And so they're all holding their etrogim called Sukkot, and they take their etrogim and they throw it at him and pelt him with etrogim. Needless to say, he wasn't very happy about that and he slaughtered everybody there. He killed thousands of others in civil wars. In another case, the Jews, looks like the Pharisees, hated him so much that they would rather have the Syrians rule them. And so they send a messenger to Demetrius, the king of the Seleucid king, and they say, please, come back and take over Jerusalem. We'll help you. Just get this guy out. And Demetrius does. And they come in, and for a short time, they're successful in kicking out Alexander Yanai. But Yanai comes back with a bigger army and kicks the Greeks out. And then he proceeds to punish those Jews who were responsible. And he crucifies these 800 Pharisees while killing their wives and children in front of them while they're on the cross. Right? So he's like a Saddam Hussein kind of character. Right? Might be a strong statement to say about Hasminian, but you see that the rabbis, nobody liked him. Okay, just an evil person. But a strange twist that Josephus tells us about. You can't know for sure if it's true, but Josephus says that on his deathbed, he told his wife, you're going to be the next queen. And if you want to be successful, you should yield to the Pharisees. Right? Me, all my life, I had to fight with them. It was very difficult. Don't be a Sadducee. Give power to the Pharisees. Right? And she does. And she becomes the first queen, the only queen during the second Beit HaMikdash. There was one queen during the first Beit HaMikdash, right? Know her? Know who she was? Atalia. Then we had one female prime minister in the modern state, right? So in every period we have one female who's ruling. Okay, so here's Alexandria Nye's coins. But this is a picture of the pomegranate. Before it's bloomed, that's the pomegranate flower. That's what they're depicting here. That's why it doesn't look quite like a pomegranate that you're used to. But he also has Yonatan. So Yanai is actually short for Yonatan. Oh. Right? We only know that because we found these coins. Hagadol, Kohen Gadol, Bechebel Yehudim. This is the early coins that he minted. That has Kohen Gadol. A few years later, he mints another coin that says Yonatan HaMelech. Okay, now he upgraded his status to king. And he changed the symbols, now an anchor, and it says King Alexander in Greek letters. What does an anchor represent? Gaza, a lot of the coast, right? Yeah. So maybe representing his triumph over the oceans now. On the other side, this is a sun disk, with inside each part of the disk, you could actually read it. You see this letter and this letter is the same? All right, so what letter is that? There's only one letter that repeats. And Yonatan HaMelech. It's a hey, right, good. So this is a yud, hey, ye, ho, na, tan. Remember, tap is like a cross. Yonatan, that's a nun. Ha, melech. Okay. So that's pretty interesting. Here's another example of that. But now we have something rather unique, is that these coins are re-stamped a bit later with the original Yonatan Kohen Gadol Bechevel HaYehudim. And later coins go back to the original with only Kohen Gadol and not king. Right? So we can reconstruct what probably happened. He called himself king, but people were unhappy with that and they rebelled. And he was forced to give up that title. Okay. Okay, so that's what we could learn from coins. Now Salome Alexandra, she gets a name, a street named after her, right? You know where? Near David's citadel, right? In Jerusalem. Shlom Sion HaMalka. She's a great queen. Her time is one of peace and prosperity. And everything is fine. she installs her son to be Kohen Gadol, while she can't be Kohen Gadol, right? That far they wouldn't go. So the problem comes when her two sons trying to decide who's going to take over after her. So really it should be Hyrcanus the second, who's oldest. But Hyrcanus is a bit of a weakling, and Aristobulus is strong, so Aristobulus tries to assert himself to be the next Kohen Gadol and leader. And each of them appeal to the Romans. The Romans are very powerful, and they're not here yet, but they're nearby. And so they both bribe the Romans to come and intervene and come on their side. Not such a good idea, because the Romans are happy to come in, and they imprison Aristobulus because he's stronger. They don't want a strong guy. They get the weak guy who they can use as a puppet, and they make him high priest. And the Romans come and they stay forever, right? Next hundreds and hundreds of years. So this is the end of independence for the Jews. Right, so it starts around the year 140 till around 60. So we have about 80 years of Jewish sovereignty. Right? And then because of our own infighting, it ends. Okay. So you have another person named Antigonus who serves for a short time. Antigonus is the last of the Hasmonean rulers, who's really just under the Romans, so it doesn't really matter. Antigonus fights with Herod. Herod is the first non-Hasmonean ruler, although he marries a granddaughter. Here's another chart. So here you have here's Selma Alexandra, and she has two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. They're the ones that fight. They each have children. One has a daughter named Alexandra. One has a son named Alexander. They marry each other, first cousins, and they have a daughter named Mariam. And this Mariam, Herod takes her as wife, and therefore he gets legitimacy because now he's married into the Hasmonean family. And then he proceeds to kill the rest of the family and kill his wife also, and that's the story of Herod. We can't get into that. This Antigonus had also prints coins in his short time, and his coins actually have a menorah and a shulchan. Right? That's pretty interesting. Okay. Looks like it goes a bit of a different turn than his predecessors. Okay. So that ends the first section I want to talk about, which is the history of what happened to the Hashmonaim. And you see that the Hashmonaim are a mixed bag. If you want to say, you know, what were the Hashmonaim? Were they good? Were they bad? Were they traditionalists? Were they Hellenists? Were they, you know, what were they? You can't really give one answer, because they were around for a while, and each generation was a bit different. But you can say in general that the first ones were traditionalists fighting for religion, and as time went on, power corrupted them, and they became more and more Hellenized. Some good types of Hellenism, but many mostly bad types of Hellenism, until they wiped themselves out, basically. Okay, so now what happens to Hellenism after that? Right? What happens to this whole movement? Where do all these people go? And I guess, you know, just because they lose power doesn't mean they disappear altogether, right? So you have all different levels of Hellenism, even in ancient times. If you go to a place like Alexandria, you see that there the sages translate the Torah into Greek, right? There's no better example of Hellenism than that. And this is a positive thing, right? Because now all these Jews there who don't read Hebrew, now they could study Torah. And you have a famous example of Philo of Alexandria, right? Great philosopher who, way before the Rambam, he's already combining Torah with Greek philosophy, you know, and saying these things, Abraham and Sarah really represent form and matter, and right, all kinds of interesting things. And he probably didn't know Hebrew. He's doing this all based on the Septuagint. Some of the more extreme Hellenizers probably ended up becoming Christians, right? Because then they could get the best of, you know, both worlds. They could kind of have the philosophical ideals of Judaism, but without any of the mitzvot, and they can, you know, bring in a lot of the Hellenistic philosophies also, and you know, combine it into one. There were many traditionalists that were still around. We'll see that Chazal have a lot of machloket about what to do with Hellenism. And in some cases they adapted, in some cases they're against it. So let's look at a few examples of what Chazal do. A famous statement says, Yaft Elohim liyefet, v'yishkon ba'al Hashem, right, the Pasuk says. And so they say, Yaft Yutosh liyefet, yeh ba'al Hashem. Yefet represents the Greeks, so the beauty of the Greeks should dwell in the tent of Shem, which is the Jews. Right? So they recognize that the Greeks have great beauty and have wonderful things to offer, but instead of saying we're going to go with them, they said we should bring that beauty and bring it into the tent of Torah and use it to beautify Torah. Okay? So it's a great thing that represents their approach. Here's a couple of examples. Famous Pirkei Avot, right? There's nothing more Jewish than Pirkei Avot. Ben Zoma says, Ezu Chacham, Halomed Mikol Adam, it brings Pasuk. Ezu Gibor, Kobeshet Yisro, right? A mighty person, is not someone who conquers others, but conquers himself. It brings a Pasuk. Who was rich, who was happy with his own lot, brings Pasuk. Who's Mechubad, who was honored, the someone who honors others. Right? So you have nice like paradoxes. Each one's ironic, right? You would think who's honored, someone who gets honor. No, someone who honors others is honored. If you look through Greco-Roman writers, you have some similar statements. Like who is sane, he who's no fool, who is free, the sage who masters himself, to be content with one's things or riches, Cicero says. A noble thing is joyful poverty. Honoring a sage is a great bonus to the heroes. Only the sage is sane, only the sage is free, only the sage is rich. Right? Not exactly the same, but there is some similarity. Right? One of the main differences is that when the rabbis quote these aphorisms, they connect it to a pasuk. Right? So they're a part of their environment, they're part of their culture, and they're taking these wisdom sayings that accord with Torah and, you know, are good lessons, and they use them to teach their students about proper midot and how to live. Another example is from Kohelet Rabbah, Midrash on Kohelet. And it quotes a pasuk that says, as one comes forth from his mother's womb, naked shall he go back as he came and take nothing for his labor. Right? A person is born with nothing, goes back to the grave with nothing. You can't take your riches with you. Okay, so the Geniva wants to teach a lesson about this, so he quotes a story. It's like a fox who found a vineyard, which was fenced in on all sides. But there was one hole through which he wanted to enter, but he was unable to do so. What did he do? He fasted for 3 days until he became lean and frail, and so got through the hole. Then he ate of the grapes and became fat again, so that he wished to go out. He could not pass through at all. He again fasted another 3 days until he became lean and frail, returning to his former condition, and went out. When he was outside, he turned his face and, gazing at the vineyard, said, O vineyard, how good are you, and the fruits inside. All that is inside is beautiful and commendable, but what enjoyment has one from you? As one enters, so he comes out, such is the world. So this is this nice story about a vineyard as a mashal to what it's like in the world. Right? You can come in, you can enjoy yourself, but you're not going to take it with you. So therefore, materialism is not really worth it. Better to focus on spiritual matters. Okay, now where does the story come from? Does it sound familiar?
Oh, yeah. Aesop's Fables.
Okay, excellent, right? This is exactly from Aesop's Fables, word for word. There's some slight differences. Hungry fox buys some bread, and he crawled in a hollow tree. He crawled in, his belly swelled, he couldn't get out. Fox came by, said, what's the matter? He says, I guess you'll just have to wait until you get back to the size you were, and then you'll be able to get out. And the moral of the story shows that time overcomes difficulties. Okay, so different moral, right? I like the rabbinic moral better, right? But you have to imagine, what happened here? How did this Aesop's Fables, much older, get into the Midrash? I don't know, maybe the rabbi was walking through the shuk one day and he heard some, you know, itinerant speaker was telling the story. He said, oh, what a nice story. He connected it to Pasuk and Kohelet and he put it together. That's probably a story that most of the people heard somewhere and knew, and so they resonated with them. And he's able to use this this Greek fable to bring home a Torah message. Go back to you.
Yes.
Exactly.
How do we know which came first, then?
I can't be sure. I don't know how much influence the Jews had over Greek writers. How were the Greek writers reading Jewish texts? They know a little bit about the Jews. They have some familiarity. It's not necessarily direct influence. It's part of the common culture. This is what people are talking about. I don't think the rabbis were reading Seneca either. They never quote anything like that. They never seem to read Plato or Aristotle or anybody like that. But it's part of the talk on the streets. These are sayings that people know. Right? You know nursery rhymes. Right? How do you know nursery rhymes? You just know it. If you live here, you know it. I don't want to go through every example, but this is just a funny one of a man who's married to two wives, an older one and a younger one, and so the older one wants to make him look older and pulls out the black hairs, and the younger one wants to make him look and pulls out the white hairs, right, until he's left with no hair at all. That's the Aesop's fable. And then there's in the Gemara, there's one rabbi, one student says, I want to learn halakha, one says, I want to learn agadah, and they won't compromise. And so the rabbi says, I'm like this man who's married to two wives, and now I'm left with, I can't teach anything, because he won't agree, and he quotes the same fable. How about studying Greek itself, studying the Greek language? Some rabbis were against it, but others were okay with it. Rabban Gamliel says, was given permission to teach the Greeks due to the relationship with the Romans. And in fact, Rabban Gamliel's son, he's a Nasi, patriarch, so he has to deal with the Romans, he has to send messengers, so he has no Greek. He says, there were 1,000 pupils in my father's house, 500 studied Torah, and 500 studied Greek wisdom. This is the first YU. I'm not sure how it worked. I don't know if it's the same 500, or some only studied Torah, and some only studied Greek. Maybe that's also like YU. Okay.
The Greek translation had a Greek translation of Torah is the initial
Right, good. So we're going to Septuagint. At first, it seemed that miraculous. The 70 sages got together and they all translated exactly the same way, right? So it was a great event. It's shown as something certainly very positive, right? But then afterwards, they say the day that the Torah was translated into Greek was like the day of Chetze Egel. They say something terrible. So what happened? It looks like at the time they translated, the 3rd century BCE, it was very positive. Many Jews were able to read Torah. But as a consequence, later on, the Christians used the Septuagint as their Bible, right? So it allowed for Christianity, and then Christianity came and persecuted Jews, so it turned back on them. So therefore, at that point, they thought of it as a negative thing. Here's another Gemara that actually discusses, can you study Greek? So it said, answer Yeshua, can you teach your son Greek? He said, there's a time that's not day and not night, because it's Vagita B'Mavalayla. There was a principle you could, but you can't take away from Torah time. So what about a trade? Well, trade is okay because you have to choose life, so you can take the time away from Torah to teach a trade, but not because of that. Now, Rabbi Abbas says because of slanderers. There's some stories that we're recording around that certain Jews who knew Greek would go over to the Greek side and tell on the Jews and tell them things that are negative, and they would use that against them. So because of these traitors, better not to teach Greek at all. So not because Greek itself is evil, but because some people are going to use it for bad. And I have that really interesting statement. Rabbi Abbas said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, one may teach his daughter Greek, for it serves her as an ornament. Right? It's not like today, piano playing or speaking French, right?
Accomplishment.
Right. It's something very refined, and it should be more marriageable if she speaks Greek. But he didn't get away with this without being criticized. Rabbi Shimon Bar, he says this in the name, this Rabbi Abahu says the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Yochanan is the greatest Amorah, second generation Amorah in Israel. Rabbi Shimon Bar heard it, he said, he only said this because he wanted to teach his daughters. He ascribed it to Rabbi Yochanan. But may a curse come upon me if I ever heard this from Rabbi Yochanan. Right? As Rabbi Shimon Bar Abba is accusing Rabbi Abahu of making up this tradition. And then Rabbi Yochanan, just because he wanted to teach his daughters Greek, but Rabbi Yochanan never said that. This is pretty harsh language, right? Even if they argue a lot, right? This is really a personal attack. So I see even back then, this is a lively debate about whether to study Greek or not. Okay, Pandora's jar, Pandora's box, right, makes its way into a midrash. I don't want to go into it now.
What is the source, though? Let me just get my notes.
Bereshit Rabbah, 179-180. Okay. So if we trace, so this is Hellenism in the time of Chazal. If we trace these ideas, you know, Torah versus Hellenism versus Greek, you see throughout history this becomes a constant question. And Rambam is famous for combining the two and, you know, making, he wrote the whole Moreh Nevuchim is really about reading the Torah philosophically, right? Joining together Aristotle and the Bible. But Rambam was very controversial, right? Some people burnt his books. We have a great statement by the Gra, Lagon Vilna. This is Rambam says, whoever, if you get bitten by a snake, you're allowed to say incantations on it, even on Shabbat. It's probably medication on Shabbat. Because in order to calm your mind, if you're saying something and you're calming it psychologically, it'll help you. Even though it doesn't help at all. Incantations don't do anything, magic doesn't work. So the Gra says that everybody after him disagreed with him. Because there are many incantations talked about in the Gra. Vehu, the Rambam, Yimshach Achala Philosophia. He pulled astray by philosophy. That's why he wrote that none of this works, because he's too rationalistic. But we see, they already hit him on his head. Because we see many places in the Gemara where you see it does work. Okay, typifies the great controversy over the place of that philosophy has in Judaism. Okay. So that's the legacy of Hellenism. Now we'll go back and talk about the legacy of the Chashmonaim. Right? What do people think about the Chashmonaim? So the Chazal looks like have statements that go both ways. Sometimes they talk about the Chashmonaim Chanukah as a great miracle. Interesting that they only talk about the miracle, right? They don't really mention the military victory anywhere in the Quran, and even Al Nisim. It talks about thank Hashem for the military victory, but nothing about the Chashmonaim themselves. Just Chashmonaim, they went in and they purified the Beit HaMikdash, right? We don't celebrate anything about the military victory or anything that they themselves accomplished. Only it's really praise of Hashem that he was able to regain Beit HaMikdash and regain and win over the enemies. Okay, that's pretty interesting in itself. Here's just one example of their attitude. There's the first source on the sheet. Says Rabbi Acha Bar Huna raised an objection. It says on the 3rd of Tishrei, the mention of God in bonds was abolished, for the Greek government had forbidden the mention of God's name by the Israelites. Okay, in the beginning, it's quoting something called Megillat Ta'anit. This was a first century CE document that listed about 30 dates on which you were not allowed to fast or mourn because they were holidays. And most of them are days on which the Chashmonaim had some kind of victory, military victory. So originally this was kept, but the rabbis abolished it. Looks like for the same reason. They didn't want to commemorate all of these Hasmonean victories. The only one that's left from it is Purim and Chanukah. Okay. So one of the events is on the 3rd of Tishrei, which is when the Greek government said, you're not allowed to use God's name anymore. That was one of their decrees. So when you're writing down contracts, you can't use God's name. When the government of the Chashmonaim became strong and defeated them, they ordained that they should mention the name of God even on bonds, and they used to write thus, in the year so-and-so of Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, the Le'el Elyon. So the Chashmonaim bring it back. Go against the Greek decrees. And when the sages heard of it, they said, tomorrow this man will pay his debt and the bond will be thrown into the dunghill. They stopped them. And they made that day a feast day. Right? So the sages undo the decree of Chazal and go back to what the Greeks had said. Right? So that's pretty interesting, right? They're going against the Chashmonaim. They don't they don't regard them as whatever they said as authoritative. And they make that a great feast day that they were able to get the popular over to their side and not do what the Hashmonim had said. Okay. So Chazal, they quote a lot of stories about the Hashmonim. They just looks like they had a good idea of what the history was, and they recognized the corrupt parts for what they were. If we go to the next generation during times of the Geonim, right? Well, what do the Geonim think about Hashmonim Chanukah? So here you have the Karaites. The Karaites are a group that we first hear about in the 9th century CE. They only believe in Torah Shebichtav. Not Torah Shebaalpeh. And so they're constantly fighting, the Karaites against the Rabbanites, over all kinds of issues. And one of them is Chanukah, right? What do you think the Karaites say about Chanukah? On the Bible, right? So that's exactly what they say. It says on the second side of the page. Lachen lo na'amin lechanukah shel rabanei ki bimei yavan batla nevua velo yaseh ot al yad she'enenu nabi sedek. Right? It's not, it happened during the time of the Greeks when there's no more prophecy and we can't make any new holidays without a proper prophet. So they're against it. Because of this, Sa'adje Gaon, he has a book called Megillat Antiochus. Megillat Antiochus is it's a book written a few centuries after the events that includes some quotes from the books of Maccabees and other legends. It's a story about, it's a Chanukah story put together. And it was passed down, and Sadegon translates it into Arabic. And he says, this is a true account of what happened, and I'm translating it to Arabic so everybody can read it. So first of all, you'll know what happened, and you'll appreciate the story of Chanukah. And second, it is against the Karaites who don't celebrate this holiday. I want everybody to celebrate it. Right? So he has a very positive take on it for polemical reasons. Okay, Rashi, I'm actually just quoting as a Targum that says something similar. This is in Dvarim. The bracha to Levi is interesting because the bracha to Levi says Urecha v'tumecha l'ish chasidecha Urim v'tumim. All services is going to do in the Beit HaMikdash. Levi is going to become, they're going to be the Kohanim. And then the last line that Moshe gives to Levi is seems out of place. Barech Hashem chelo ufol yadav teseh, bless his military strength and his act, the deeds of his hands. All his enemies should be destroyed and not be able to rise. What enemies do Levi have? They don't have land. They don't have to conquest land. They don't find any stories in Nevi'im where they have strong military accomplishments. Right. So what is this talking about? So as she says, Moshe saw in the future. Rashi atidin chashmonai ubanav lelachtim im hayevanim. V'itpalel alehem lefi shehem mu'atim. You saw Hashmonai, the Kohanim from Levi. They're going to have to fight the Greeks. And they're very few, only 12. Right? Including the children and grandchildren. V'nech Hashmonai be'elazar k'neged kamar yevavot against many tens of thousands. V'achen ne'emar b'alech Hashem chelo v'ol edav tirseh. So that's why Moshe was blessing them. Right? So here obviously something positive. Right? Hashmonim, they're fulfilling the blessing that Moshe gave them. So they are doing something positive. But here also, you can distinguish. She's talking about the first Hashmonaim, who first do it, and the other source is talking about later Hashmonaim. Okay, Ramban, a very famous statement, talks about the Hashmonaim, and he says, it's my opinion that any time the Jews have over them a leader who's not from the line of Yehuda, it causes bad. And the Chashmonaim, the reason they weren't successful, even though the first ones were great Hasidim and were very righteous, but they all died in battle, and later on they were not successful, and the reason is because they were not from the line of Yehuda. And you can't, right, lo yasu shevet mi Yehuda, the kingship should only belong to them, and not to anyone else. Maybe for a short time, some other tribes couldn't have it, but not for a long time, and certainly not Kohanim. They have the religious duties. They're never allowed to be. They're never allowed to be kings. So that's first of all. And then he also says they made themselves Kohen Gadol, and they shouldn't have done that. And a different place says here's look the second to last source. We caused the beginning of our downfall. He's talking about when Yaakov sends messengers to Esav. Right? He says this foreshadows something in the future. The kings on the second Beit HaMikdash, he's talking about the Maccabees. The Maccabees, early on, sent messengers to Rome for help, for a treaty. Now, see, Rome was had their eye on the east, eventually want to take over. So it was in Rome's interest to keep the Greek empire separate. Right, so they wanted to make sure that Ptolemies and Seleucids kept separate, and any small group that was fighting against them, the Romans supported. So the Maccabees made a treaty with Rome, and the Ramban says this was a mistake also. The Ramban only knows this because he read the Book of Maccabees. Ramban read a few apocrypha. He quotes from the wisdom of Solomon and other books of apocrypha. So he knew the Book of Maccabees. That was the cause of their downfall. Right there, engaged in his political acts, and they shouldn't have been doing that. Okay, so Ramban has a very negative attitude. It looks like because he knew more about the history than other people. Okay, so now if we go down to modern times, how do we remember Chashmonaim today? So first we have to, the real revival of the Chashmonaim happened because of the Zionists, right? The secular Zionists. Secular Zionists, especially, the ones that were communists, they really didn't have any regard for religion, wanted to do away with all these holidays and old things. But they said, Chanukah is very, very powerful in the imagination of the people, and we can use it to our advantage, right? Here's a story of a group that came back after many years and regained the Beit HaMikdash and regain sovereignty over Israel. Let's use them as a model. And so they do. They talk about how they're going to be the Maccabees. Herzl, at the last line of his book, says, "The Maccabees shall rise again." Okay. Now, his one problem is that the Maccabees were really originally religious fighters, right? So what do they do with that? So look how they edit history. The famous song, right? Mi Yimalel Gerot Yisrael, right? Who can say of all the mighty deeds of Israel, or Tam, who can count them? Hen Bechol Dor Yakum HaGibor Gvel Ha'am. In every generation, a strong person comes up to redeem the nation. Listen, in their days, in this time, Maccabi Moshiach Pode, a Maccabi rises up to redeem them, and in a narrow day all of Israel should unify and stand up and bring redemption. Okay? Sounds like a nice song, right? We'll sing it. Maccabees even sing it. But look at the original. The original comes from Tehillim. Me, Malel, Giburot, Hashem. They take out Hashem and they put in themselves, right? Israel. Also Bechol Dor, right, what is that? Right? They're always going to come up against us, but God saves us. But here, Bechol Dor, Yakum HaGibor. They didn't mean God as the Gibor, right? They meant that we with our might, right? So, look, I mean, they're using it, for with good intentions. I mean, the typical stereotype of the Jew in there, right, that time is, all pale and weak and doesn't know how to defend for himself and just takes on persecution without doing anything about it. And they want to show portray a Jew as strong, military. We can stand up for ourselves. We're going to fight. And so they have an example from history, right? And so they use it successfully. So that's that's one way that is taken. By other historians, including from Rabbi Beryl Wein, who I have a lot of respect for, even though he doesn't follow exactly the historical method, but he's still very interesting to read because you get a good perspective on at least how the rabbis are viewing it. And he's always, whatever he says, always based on some source, right? He knows the sources. He says something as the follows: he says, "What happened to the Hellenists? The difference all but collapsed in the wake of the defeat. They would never return again as Hellenists because the war brought out their true colors as traitors, and they lost whatever appeal they could have had to the Jewish people. Most of them retreated to the city of Caesarea, which remained a Greek city, and they were just not part of the Jewish people any longer." Right? So there is some truth to this, that right, these extreme Hellenists were not in power anymore, but it's not like they just disappeared. Right? They were always around. And really, a lot of people talk about Chanukah as the fight against assimilation, against any outside culture, right? Keep everything out. But that's not quite accurate historically either, right? I mean, the Hasmonim are a mixed bag, and so you can use them for many different things. Some of them were very similar to secular Zionists. Some of them were religious extremists. But generally, if we look at them, the truth is that they were more like... wait for just a second. They were more something in the middle, something of a combination. So if you look at someone like Rav Kook quotes looks to the Maccabees as a source of someone who remains true to their Torah, to Judaism, but also brings in the positive aspects from outside culture, right? Which is what Rav Kook himself does, right? So they're a kind of Torah Mada example. And there's some truth. There's always dangerous to, whatever philosophy you happen to have, brings things from history to support your whatever you think. And well, everybody does that, so I guess we can do that too, right? But I think there is a lot of historical justification, and we saw many examples of it. So they represent, or they can represent. Some of them represent the dangers of going too far and doing too much, but some of them represent a positive a balance between them. And then the Maccabees are also looked to by the Gush Emunim, the religious Zionists, right? Rav Lichtenstein has a lecture where he talks about this, and the Maccabees are a symbol of people who are involved in Torah and religion, but not only that, but they also go to the army, right? And fight the war and stand up for the land of Israel. Right, they're the Hizdernics. They are, right? I mean, it is a good example. So, you see, the Maccabees is just a very powerful influence, very powerful in everybody's memory. And because the sources are so complex, they are, in fact, variegated, so we can look at them in different ways. But it's really important to know about them because, I mean, modern Judaism is going through a lot of different things. This is a lot of new things that was not the same as it was in the old countries. Now we're settling in America and the influences of Americanism and having a state of Israel with all the challenges that includes about secularism and religion and how dealing with power. That's the challenge. But the good news is that this is not the first time the Jewish people has had to confront these things. Deep are the conflicts that we see around us today, the conflicts were actually always around. And I think probably today we're dealing with it in a more healthy way than they were back then, if that's any encouragement. So, just to end with a quote from Elias Brueggemann, great historian of the period. So Judaism was able to enrich itself with new and foreign ideas and to be saved from the mummification that overtook the religion of Egypt, for example, which shut itself off from Hellenism completely. Right? To shut yourself off, that has a lot of dangers. There's a lot of groups of Judaism that weren't willing to change, like the Sadducees, like the Essenes, one way, and they couldn't think outside the box, and so they became extinct because they couldn't handle the new situation that was going on. The Maccabees preserved the Judaism of the Greek period from both dissolution and ossification. It's through their deeds that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob could and did remain our God. So this is the challenge that the Hasmonim present us, and we hope that we start off on the right foot and we don't let power and bad influences of outside corrupt us. But we're able to stay on the true path, the middle path, and hopefully as each year goes forward and we are more successful in politically, economically, and also spiritually, Chanukah will take on that much more meaning and more reason to celebrate. So thank you.
Chanukah Shmeirah. Thank you.
Oh, he said it was like an old Jewish song. Yeah.
It was interesting what you were saying about the Septuagint. I never put together that first it started out as a positive thing. Where are the sources? Where was it first started out as a positive and then switched? Were there sources that?
Yeah, yeah. Cassandra. You know,
okay.
Yeah.
Like the Jewish
Oh, really?
Yeah, I actually saw the bridge. I didn't kill it.